Yeah. Hi everyone. Just checking everyone can hear me okay. Do we have some sound? I'll assume that we'll have some sound, and if not, we'll hopefully hear back from you. So I'm Bande Sujato, and I'm very happy to be here with you this evening at the Amawatarat Buddhist Temple in Carlingford. I'm hearing my own voice on the other side of the room, so I'm assuming that the sound is working okay. All right. So, very wonderful to spend some time with you today. And I, you know, want to ask everyone just to relax, just get ready, and to enjoy spending a bit of time talking about and contemplating on Dhamma. And we've already had a chance to do the beautiful Buddha Puja, Buddha Vandana, with the Venerables here. And now we get the chance to spend some time with the Dhamma and some time with something that's really lovely. So I think that's a very, such a great blessing and such a great privilege for all of us. Now, before we proceed, I do have one announcement to make that I'll repeat at the end, but just so that you know that, and this will come as a shock. Any of you who know me then will probably not really be shocked by this at all, but I've managed to double book my talk for tomorrow. So long story short, we're going to move the session back half an hour tomorrow because I'm doing another event earlier in the evening. So I'll say this again at the end, but tomorrow's talk will be half an hour later than scheduled. That is starting at 8, the talk will start at 8 p.m. In Sydney time, Eastern Australian Daylight Savings time. Okay, so for this evening, the talk is Living Happily with Morality in the Modern World. And I'm going to just sort of reflect on a few of the issues and ideas around this. And I assume that most of the people here probably have a reasonable amount of familiarity with the basic Buddhist ideas of morality and the five precepts and these kinds of things. So what I'm going to try to do is maybe reflect on it and draw out some aspects of it that perhaps maybe help to show it in a new light or to appreciate things in a way that we might not normally do so. The first thing I have to say from my background, obviously I'm born in Australia, grew up in Australia, and as such, my conditioning, my childhood conditioning in these kinds of matters is very different. I was brought up as a Catholic, and I was brought up as an Australian Catholic, which is, well, it's not, which means not very Catholic. I mean, it means a bit Catholic. We went to church every week, and I went to a Catholic school, but you know, it was kind of softly Catholic, I guess. You know, we weren't really kind of hardcore religious family or anything, but you know, my parents did have faith, and my sister, and we did go to the church, and we did, do religion classes and things through school and these kinds of things. So that kind of helped to inform my own values and my own beliefs, both in positive and negative ways. When I left school, I went to university and I studied philosophy. And the reason I studied philosophy was because I didn't know what I wanted to do. And all my friends were going and doing engineering or doing law or going off to work or doing something. And I'm like, I don't know what I want to do. So I'll do philosophy and maybe I'll find out what I want to do. So that's what I did. And, one of the things that I specialized in was moral philosophy, and I did quite a lot of study in that area at the time. And so study of moral philosophy I found was very interesting and it's very useful. But one of the things that that study of moral philosophy didn't really prepare me for was when I encountered Buddhism much later on. And the Buddha made this very fundamental connection between morality and happiness. And when you keep precepts and when you live a moral life, you become happy. And that connection between morality and happiness was something that I had never encountered before. It was brand new to me. Now, look, maybe I'm just stupid. Maybe I missed out things that are important in those different traditions and whatever, quite likely. But for me, that was something that I'd never thought of it in that way. And throughout my whole Catholic upbringing, throughout even studying moral philosophy, I hadn't really got that point that one of the reasons for doing morality was that it made you happy. Now, of course, that's not the only reason that we keep morality. We also keep morality because, well, it helps others, and because it's a good thing to do. It's an intrinsically good thing to do. But that dimension of it that it makes you happy is really important. Why? Because ultimately human beings are not always motivated by purely altruistic and noble intentions. And if you say to somebody, you should do this because it's the right thing to do, even though it's hard and painful and difficult, then okay, some people might try and that's good, but a lot of people are going to drop off. If we can say this is noble and worthwhile and a good thing to do and it will make you happy, then you're going to have a much greater success rate. We were just saying, talking about this before the talk, talking with Venerable Lakhalikho and the people here that we go for Bindabhata in the mornings to our local street, Wigram Street in Harris Park. And up until now, because of the COVID, we've restricted going for Bindabhata, but we've recently just started again. And it's one of our favorite things to do. And for exactly this reason. Today we met and were speaking with the owner of one of the restaurants down in Wigram Street. It's an Indian area, so mostly Indian restaurants. And he was a Sikh, and he was, he came after us actually. We actually went past the place, and he chased us down and said, "Oh, what can I offer you?" And said, "Oh, please, come and, will you take cooked food or raw food?" And I think he first tried to give us some money, and we said, "No, thanks, we don't take money." And then said, "Oh, some cooked food or raw food?" We said, "Well, we'll just take some cooked vegetarian food if you have any." And so he invited us back to his restaurant, and he was talking about what they do there. And they actually have a program of giving away free food at the restaurant. And he was talking about it, and you could see so much joy and so much love in what he was doing, that he just loved. He said that sometimes they would give away 750 meals in a night. Can you imagine that, running a restaurant and just doing that? And he said, it makes me so happy. It makes me feel good. It makes me feel peaceful. And it makes me sleep well at night. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine all of those things? These days we have so many treatments for all of these things, right? So if you want to sleep well at night, you can take a pill, you can whatever, go to a sauna, a spa, or maybe, all of these different things. Or you can buy some technological gadget that you can put and make sounds that'll be soothing and all of these things to make you sleep well at night. But if you want to sleep well at night, why not try giving something? It's simple. It's easy. We all have things that we can give, and it makes you happier and makes you can sleep well at night. One of the most interesting things that he said was that he said that because they had so many people coming to get the free food that they were giving away, that sometimes some of the other restaurants in the area complained. Right? They said they're taking away your customers because you're feeding everybody for free. And he said it was not my intention. I didn't want to hurt any of the other restaurants. And, I really, he could see he was very sincere that this was not what he was trying to do. And he said, I think that they don't understand that if you give that away, that it will attract more people to the area, that you're actually bringing people in and you're creating that positive energy in the area that will benefit everybody in the place. And you can imagine that that's really true, that many people would come there to get the free food, and then afterwards maybe go down the street and have a cup of coffee or have something else. And you're building up that positive energy and that happiness within that whole kind of area. So you can imagine what it would be like, what this world would be like if people really did that, if that was our motivation to bring that happiness to people through the good deeds that we were doing. So this is exactly what the Buddha was talking about. And this is not It's not a fairy tale. It's not just a story in some ancient book. It's something that's very real and that you can experience right here and right now. So this connection between that, what we do that creates happiness, and the morality, and that fundamental connection is so important in Buddhism. Now I'm going to just step back a little bit from talking about morality and just talk about happiness in the context of Buddhism to start with, and then I'll come back to the topic of morality in particular. Now, happiness in Buddhism. Now, Buddhism sometimes gets a bit of a bad rap. People say that it's kind of a depressing religion because we talk about dukkha all the time. Dukkha, dukkha, dukkha. Suffering, suffering, suffering. And I had a friend of mine who was a Christian pastor, an Anglican pastor, and he said, you know, Buddhist story, you're always so talking about suffering. And he was a good friend of mine. He didn't mean anything. He's actually married to a Buddhist teacher, so he wasn't like being down on Buddhism or anything like that. He's just saying, oh, you talk about suffering. And I wanted to say, well, our statue is of a Buddha image, which is a man sitting smiling peacefully. What's your statue? What do you worship? The suffering is a reality. And it's part of our spiritual path, no matter what religion you're from or what background you have. That's the reality of the world that we're living in. And if we're going to be just avoiding it, pretending that it's not there, then this is not a path that is really grounded in the truth, in the reality. So the Buddha's first concern was about the truth. He wanted us to understand the way the world is, because that way we can let go of it. So there is suffering in the world. That's the reality that we have to deal with, and trying to deny that and trying to pretend that it's not real is not very helpful. But the path, but what the Buddha said is that we're not just stuck in suffering, that we can do something about it. Okay, so this is what the Buddha taught in the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the origin of suffering. And the origin of suffering is the craving that we experience inside ourselves, the craving, that attachment, that aversion. And the Buddha spoke about this in many different ways in different contexts. Sometimes moha, lobha dosa moha, so greed, hate, and delusion. Sometimes as the 10 samyojanas, sometimes as the 7 anusayas, sometimes as avijja and craving. There's so many different ways of talking about it, but when it comes back to it, it's all talking about that same thing, is those unwholesome impulses that underlie our mind, that create like a force or a power in our mind that make us do things that are harmful for ourselves and for others. And so as long as we're attached to that and we can't let go of it, then we continue to make craving. Now, this is the second noble truth. And the second noble truth is, it's challenging because it tells us that we can't blame anybody else. It tells us that we have to accept responsibility for the suffering that we create within ourselves. That's the reality of it. Our suffering is our fault. And that's not to say that there isn't suffering created in the world. Of course there is, right? Sickness is suffering, and social ills are suffering, environmental disasters are suffering, and so on. These are real, genuine sources of suffering. But we can't necessarily control these. We can to some degree, but we can't, you know, ultimately we can't escape that reality of suffering in the world. But the way that we respond to it and the suffering we experience inside ourselves, that we can respond to, because that comes from our attachments. Now, so here is where it gets tricky, because if we accept that that source of suffering is from inside ourselves, then again, if we get stuck on that, if that's where we end up, then it can be kind of depressing, right? Not only is there suffering in the world, but it's my fault, right? You see the problem here. If you genuinely understand the second noble truth, this pain, everything is my fault. That's bad, isn't it? Yeah, that's hard to deal with. It's a hard thing to accept. So luckily, the Buddha didn't teach just two noble truths. He also taught the third noble truth, which is that we can become free of this suffering. So he held out this possibility of this freedom. Now, okay, very good. This is what we call Nibbana, the ending of suffering. And it's one thing to just say we can have that state of freedom from it, right? Anybody can say that. But what does it mean? And in particular, how do we get there? And one of the things interesting about the suttas is that when the Buddha was teaching these four noble truths, if you analyze and look closely in the suttas at how he taught these four noble truths, everything he said, all of his teachings were in the four noble truths. But if you have a look at how he taught it, I actually did a analysis of it one time about, I can't remember the exact numbers were, but it was about something like maybe like 15% of the teachings were about the first noble truth, 10% or 15%, maybe 5%. Oh no, maybe like 10% each of the first two noble truths, maybe 5% of the third noble truth, and about 75% were about the fourth noble truth. Something like that. Don't quote me on those numbers. It was a long time ago I did that. And it doesn't really work because, of course, they're all connected anyway. But you get the basic point. So the Buddha talked about Nibbana, but he didn't like talk about it in, he wasn't so much interested in sort of trying to explain all of the metaphysics and the philosophy of Nibbana, because how far does that get you? The main point is to realize that there is this ending of suffering. Then you have to understand, how do you get there? And that's the path, right? The fourth noble truth. And that's what the Buddha focused on most of the time when he was teaching. What is the path to the ending of suffering? Now, the thing about the path is that the path itself is suffering, right? It's a conditioned creation, and it itself is suffering. If you've ever meditated, for example, and you sit in meditation, and that's part of the path to freedom from suffering, but meditation itself can be quite stressful. It can be quite painful. You can experience physical pain. Emotionally, it can be quite challenging. So that path is still part of that way of dukkha. But the path leads to gradually more and more refined forms of happiness. And each of the stages of the path as we go down will allow... Like in one way you can say that it generates or it creates a form of happiness, but what's really happening or how it feels like is that it allows these forms of happiness to manifest and to arise in ways that it seems like it was there already. It seems these things come up. It feels like we're not creating this happiness. It feels like somehow we just stopped blocking it. We stopped hiding from it. We stopped, I guess, doing those things that are stopping ourselves from feeling happy. So it's interesting to reflect on why that is, like why we make ourselves feel unhappy when happiness is right there. Right? Why do we do bad things when we know that good things will lead to happiness? Why do we get angry when we know that love makes us happy? So this is all that power of greed, hate, and delusion, which is twisting our mind and sending us into directions that will create the very conditions that we're trying to escape, and will create the suffering, even though all we want to do is to leave the suffering. So, this is that position that we're in. And like any, like complex problem, hard problem, it looks insurmountable. And you look at that problem of suffering out in the world, and you look at that suffering, how you're creating it, and your attachments, and all these kinds of things. It's crazy. We're creating a suffering through our attachments in every moment. There's nothing we can do about it. We're just lost. And these kind of terms that the Buddha had used to describe this state, you know, he talked about like being overwhelmed, like being stuck in the mud, like stuck in the bog. He talked about being like fettered, like chained up. And all of these kind of imagery around this state of ignorance that we're normally in, that point to a kind of a feeling of helplessness and a feeling that we don't have any choice or don't have any power to do anything about this. And when we're faced with a situation like that, then the skillful thing to do, what we have to do, is to focus on what's practical and focus on, well, what's the next step? If we want to say, are we going to get rid of all of that mountain of suffering that we've accumulated over the years, right? Remember the similes that the Buddha said, that the amount of tears that you have shed in all your births in samsara is greater than all of the waters in the oceans. My God, how do we relate to that? How do we dry up those oceans of tears? Well, we start with doing something that's simple and practical that we can actually achieve. This is how the Buddha laid out the path. And so the foundation of the path is good conduct in one's sila or one's ethics or morality. This is the first step. We're not going to worry about fully letting go of everything, transcending all of existence and realizing the ultimate stage of nibbana, okay? Not yet, anyway. Let's take the first step there. Let's at least make a difference. What's that first step? Well, let's stop killing things. Can we do that? Can we stop killing? If we look at the world around us, right? Look at nature. Look at how beautiful and how precious life is. Every flower, how beautiful it is. Every blade of grass, how much richness and complexity there is to just make a blade of grass. Every insect, even just a little ant that's crawling in your home, how incredible that is. You know, and even all of our science and technology, we can't produce anything that's as amazing as an ant. Every fish in the sea, how astonishing is every fish, a beautiful silver fish, so elegant, swimming through the ocean. The whales, the sharks, the huge trees in the forest, that life which surrounds us has so much beauty, so much variety, so much that's valuable in that. And we are part of it. We are part of it. We're part of nature. We're just one bit of nature. These days we like to think that we're not. We sort of lock ourselves up in our houses and we wear clothes and we use technology and we do all of these things and we like to pretend that somehow we're separate from nature. But no, we're just one of the manifestations of nature. And that life is what makes consciousness possible. It's what makes the experience of pleasure and pain possible. And ultimately, it's what makes the practice of the Dhamma and the realization of Nibbana possible. And so the Buddha laid down the first precept, the precept against taking life, as being the foundation of the moral life. In the Chakravarti Sihanada Sutta, in the Digha Nikaya, the Buddha spoke about the decline of society ending in a global apocalypse. Everything falls apart and people just hide out from each other and when they see each other just try to kill each other. Until eventually nobody has any trust, any respect for each other, and civilization falls, everything's gone. Until eventually one man sees another man, and they say, oh my goodness, there's somebody else who's alive. I never knew that there was somebody else who was alive, and they rush and they hug each other, and they're so full of joy to realize that there's another living being still alive. And that joy in life and in the realization of life is the foundation of everything that's good, everything that comes afterwards. And in that story, in the Chakavati Sihanada Sutta, they then think, okay, let's start again. Let's do it again, and let's do it better this time. And they say, well, how do we start again? What's the foundation of everything? What's the foundation for building a people, building a society, building a civilization, building a world that's worth living in? What's the foundation of all of those things? Let's not kill. Let us respect all life, and let us never kill. And so they undertook that precept, and they took that as a bond between them, and with that as the foundation, they started to rebuild. And according to the sutta, that led ultimately to the arising of the great wheel-turning emperor Sankar and the king, and the Buddha Maitreya in a long time in the future. And so that arising of the Buddha and the appearance of the Buddha Sasana ultimately builds on that very first precept, not to kill. Amazing, right? If you think of it that way, how powerful that is, that if we have that precept, not to kill, everything becomes possible. Everything, up to and including Buddhahood and the establishment of the Sasana, becomes possible. But without that precept, if we neglect the value of life, it will all fall apart. So this is the foundation of our moral life. Now, when we're thinking about this precept, then if we even think within the five precepts, okay, the precept on killing is actually the most fundamental, and all of the others are actually contingent, if you think about it, right? So the second precept is about not stealing. So the precept about not stealing is only relevant if you're in a society where you have personal property. Not all societies do have personal property. In, say, some Aboriginal societies or Kalahari Bushmen societies, then they don't really have this concept of personal property because they just share what nature gives them. So this is something that's socially dependent. The precept against sexual misconduct also is socially dependent, right? Depends on the way that society is organized. Relations between people. Precept against lying also is socially dependent. If you don't have language, then how can you have lying? In fact, even in the Jataka stories, one of the Jataka stories tells the origin story for lies. He said, previous to this, then nobody lied. Actually, that's even in the, I think in the Aganya Sutta as well, it talks about that. People have this, there's a certain point in time when people realize that they could intentionally deceive each other. And then the precept on alcohol and drugs also is provisional, right? Not everywhere is going to have alcohol and drugs necessarily. So all of those precepts are actually socially dependent. They're dependent on the structures that society has that makes it possible to break those precepts. Whereas that first precept, the precept against killing, is not socially dependent in that same way. It's dependent not on a particular way that we have organized our society. It's dependent on the fact that we are living beings, the fact that we're alive and that we share this life with all other beings on this planet. We are part of nature. Our life is part of the life of others. Inside each of you, as you are sitting there, this evening, listening to Dhamma, contemplating Dhamma, sharing Dhamma together, you do this because you're alive. Pay attention to that. Pay attention to what it feels like to be alive. What is that feeling of life inside you, the warmth? And what is it like when that goes? If you die, when you die, the body becomes cold, it becomes stiff, and there's no consciousness. The Buddha described it, apeta vinyano, niratangva kalingaram. Apeta vinyano, consciousness is left, it's gone. Nirat Hangla Galingaram, useless as an old log. Hate to say it, but that's where we're headed. We're going to be as useless as an old log. Actually, probably less useless than an old log. At least you can throw an old log on the fire. Whereas when we go, we're nothing but a hassle for all of our family who remain and have to look after us. So this life that we possess, which connects us with all other forms of life, inside us, we have countless creatures who are not us. Bacteria and all kinds of things. I don't even know what. And they say that there's more non-human DNA in the human body than there is human DNA. Kind of creepy, right? If you think about it too much. And we are also sharing our life with others. And this is something that has become so apparent in such a devastating way during the COVID pandemic. What is inside us, we breathe it out. Other people breathe it in. And so our being, our body, our nature, our life is shared with those of others. So what that means is that just as our Sikh friend with his restaurant knew that by giving to others, he would make himself happy, but he wouldn't just make himself happy, he would lead to the flourishing of his whole area. The whole street would flourish. Life would flourish. And so this is what keeping this precept does, and this is what keeping morality does. It makes us happy, but it doesn't make us happy with the kind of the narrow and shallow happiness that we get when we get something. Of course, there are plenty of ways we can make ourselves happy. We can watch a funny video on YouTube, or we can take a pill that will make us happy, or we can whatever, we can... You know, there's so many things we can do to make, go shopping. Some people apparently find that happy. I find it stressful. And I almost never do it. I go to a shopping center maybe once in a year. And as soon as I walk through the door, I'm like, oh no, it's too much. Why do people enjoy doing this? But anyway, apparently some people like going shopping. So there you go. So those things that give us happiness, but they give us this happiness that has this sort of, that has, you know, think about the qualities of the happiness that those things give you. One thing, the quality of that happiness they give you is that it's very short-lived, right? So you get something, it feels good, but then it's kind of over almost as soon as it starts. Think about that. Think about how short-term that happiness of that sensual happiness is. Like imagine if you're like in a restaurant, and you order a delicious meal, and you start eating the food, and you eat the first bite of that food, and you're like, that's so delicious. I love it so much. And then the second bite, by the third bite, your intention's already wavering, and by the fourth bite, you're already chatting with your friend, and you're not really tasting the food anymore. And this is how quickly that these kind of sensual pleasures will disappear. Again, it's not to say that it isn't a kind of pleasure. I mean, obviously it is. And the Buddha never said that you shouldn't enjoy those kinds of pleasures. He just said, do it in moderation and understand that this is how they are. Don't fool yourself about them. So if you want to have a nice meal, you want to have a nice time, spend time with your family, all those things you want to do that you enjoy, great, do those things. Yeah. But don't mistake them for the thing that's most important in your life. But the joy and the happiness that we get from morality, from keeping ethics, this goes a lot deeper. And it goes a lot deeper because it goes to the heart of letting go. The happiness of morality is a happiness that comes from letting go. To return to the topic of the first precept, if we kill, then we are acting out of that hate and that anger, but we're also acting out of a sense of delusion because we are not understanding that sense of connection between ourselves and others. So because of that lack of appreciation of our connection, then there's delusion in there as well. Whereas if we refrain from killing, and if we as much as we possibly can, if we protect and cherish all life, then that happiness will come quite naturally. And it's sometimes a subtle thing. It's sometimes it's easy to miss it, right? You might get used to sort of doing things that are good and you don't really notice the sense of happiness that's there. So this is why it's important to reflect on it and to bring it up, to remind yourself, and especially to remind yourself in your meditation, or if you're doing a chanting, if you're doing like evening puja or vandana, then during the time of the vandana, then take that chance to remind yourself as you're doing that chanting about the good things that you've done that day, about the precepts that you've kept. If you're doing the chants of taking the precepts, then remind yourself. Don't just sort of chant them the words mindlessly, but use it as a chance to check in with yourself. Have I kept this precept since the last time I chanted this? Yes. Okay, good. Great. Rejoice in that. And keep doing it in the future. If you've broken the precept, okay, understand why it is that you broke it and then try to do better next time. So in Buddhism, we don't really have a concept of guilt. If you break the precept, then, okay, it happens, right? But it's not up to you to punish yourself, to make yourself feel bad about it. What will happen if you break the precept is you feel remorse. And there's a difference between remorse and guilt. Okay, so remorse is like a kind of, like I mentioned before about how that feeling of that the happiness comes up like it's a natural feeling of happiness that we kind of occlude. We hide that natural feeling of happiness. And when we keep our precepts, we have that letting go from keeping the precepts and the happiness can come up. What the remorse is when that process is reversed. So we don't do what's good and then that something comes in and we lose that sense of happiness and we experience that as a pain or as a sadness or as a worry or as a sense of loss. And so that's a natural psychological process. So that's what we call remorse in Buddhism or kukucha. But what we don't have in Buddhism is a concept of guilt. So guilt is a separate concept which is about making a judgment about the fact that you should feel suffering. You should feel bad. Right? And so guilt is like something which is overlaid on top of the remorse and makes it worse. And it wants to, and it's like, I'm going to make myself feel bad because that's how I'm going to atone for my bad deed. You see the difference here. So remorse is like a natural feeling. It comes when it from a loss of your virtue, whereas guilt is an unnatural imposition on that feeling, which sort of stems from the false idea that by making ourselves feel bad, we will somehow atone for that guilt. So in Buddhist point of view, you don't atone for the guilt by making yourself feel bad. You atone for the guilt by doing better next time. And so this is what we always say, and this is part of our regular confession for the monks, is that we recite this. If we have done something wrong, we would confess that to the other, and then we say, do you see it? Right? So you have to be able to recognize that what you've done is wrong. And then if you see it, then ayating sangvari sami, I will restrain myself in the future. Okay? So there's nothing in there about you're bad, you should feel bad, you're guilty, you did a bad thing. Right? There's nothing about that. It all says once you recognize it, then ayating sangvari sami. Yeah? Sadhusuttu, ayating sangvari sami. And we even put those words in there, sadhusuttu. It's wonderful, it's good. I will do better next time. What a beautiful attitude that is about doing wrong. Sadhu suttu bante sangvari sami. Sadhu suttu. It's so good. It's so wonderful that you've pointed this out, right? That we know. We've acknowledged this. Ayating sangvari sami. I will restrain myself in the future. So this is the Buddhist attitude towards when we break our precepts and we do something that's bad. So when we keep our precepts, we do something that's good, then what we experience is like a little bit of a letting go. A letting go of some of the stronger and the coarser forms of those defilements, those fetters, those anusayas and what have you. So many words the Buddha used for these defilements, ogres and the floods and the bogs and the fires and all of these things. So we're beginning to let go of these. So we let go of the strongest forms of these, and we experience that little bit of happiness in there. And this is that part of that path to Nibbana. The happiness of Nibbana is not something different from the happiness that we experience as a matter of keeping ethics and doing the right thing. Happiness in Nibbana is just the maturation. It's the fulfillment of that same experience. It's the happiness of letting go. That's all. We don't need to get too fancy about it. The main description the Buddha said for Nibbana is the ending of greed, hate, and delusion. So if we end greed, hate, and delusion a little bit, we experience a little bit of happiness. If we end it a lot, we experience a lot of happiness. And if we end it completely, we experience complete happiness. So morality is part of that fundamental path of the Buddha's teachings, the Noble Eightfold Path, and it leads to and provides the foundation for all of the higher practices up to and including enlightenment. Now, that doesn't mean that these moral teachings are basic teachings. The fact that they're fundamental doesn't mean that they're basic. Well, what I mean by that is it doesn't mean that it's something that you just get done and then move on. All right? And so this is the way that sometimes people tend to think about morality in Buddhism sometimes, that for example, we can keep our precepts. Well, that's done now. All right. I can check that box off my list, right? I've kept my precepts for this week. I've done morality now, right? No. That's not how it works, right? You're just beginning. Yeah? So when the Buddha taught things like the five precepts, what he was doing was giving a basic standard for your morality, for your ethical conduct. He's saying, look, you know, whatever you do, don't get below this level, right? But the five precepts, of course, can never be more than like a simple checklist of some of the important principles of morality. It's never meant to be a complete description of moral behavior. So it's a basic thing that anybody can remember and that anybody can mostly keep, or at least aspire to keeping most of the time. But there's still, we should see our moral life and our ethical life as being something that is cultivated and grown throughout our entire life. We should always be looking for new opportunities to learn and to become better people. And understanding ways that these precepts apply in ways that we didn't even think were possible before. So I'll give you some examples of what I mean by this. So, for example, again, coming back to the first precept. Now, when we think about the first precept, hopefully when we think about that, we're not talking about murderers, okay? So I'm talking about the people who are on the chat today. Hopefully none of you are serial killers, so that's good, okay? If there's anybody on the chat who is a serial killer, then contact me afterwards, okay? We'll have a chat about that, all right? But hopefully no. Right, so hopefully most people here are not contemplating actually murdering human beings. So usually when it comes to our own conduct of keeping this, of course, a lot of it was more harder in the older days. Like if you're living in a village or something like that and you'd go fishing or you'd maybe kill the chicken for this evening's dinner, then that was kind of harder to keep. These days we tend to outsource our killing, right, so that we can have a bit less guilt around it because no one likes having blood and guts around the place. So for us, the immediate thing that we see killing may be ants in the kitchen or cockroaches. If you're in Sydney, there's a lot of cockroaches around the place. We're coming into the summer, so there'll be a lot of flies all over the place. And so if we have a fly on us, then what do we do? Right? So they can get very annoying in Australia, depending on where you are and the season that you're in. And so from a Buddhist point of view, we try not to kill, even in those kinds of cases. If you have cockroaches in your kitchen, there are many things you can do in terms of, primary thing you can do is keep your kitchen as clean as possible, lock all the food up in sealed boxes if you can, and you can use various things that will be like smelly things, like eucalyptus oil or cloves or different kinds of things that you can put around your kitchen that will tend to drive them away. So there are a lot of things that you can try to do short of actually killing them. Now, what you actually do with that at the end of the day can be difficult, and sometimes there are genuine issues, right, to be dealt with. But the core of that is the recognition that there is a moral dilemma. Like, you know, somebody said, well, what do you do if you have a young child or a baby and it's a malaria zone? Is it okay to kill mosquitoes in that kind of case? Well, if it was up to me and it was my baby, yes, I would probably kill the mosquitoes. Sorry, mosquitoes, if I couldn't keep them all away, if that was the only choice. But I would try not to, and I would recognize that this is a genuine dilemma, that the life of my baby, yes, is more precious to me than the life of a mosquito. But still, it doesn't mean that the life of a mosquito is worth nothing, right? So we recognize that we are genuinely trying to preserve any kind of life, even a mosquito. So these are the kinds of dilemmas that we think about when we think about keeping the first precept. Another one that comes up a lot is with pets. You know, when your pet gets very sick and maybe you have to put the pet down, this also is a dilemma that people have. And there are other issues like that. I won't go into all of the issues around that. But what I want to point out here, or what I want to sort of suggest, is that we can also extend the scope of that precept about not killing, because that precept of not killing ultimately stems from the understanding of the preciousness and the sacredness of all life. And if that's the case, then should we not be living in a way that is going to be supporting the flourishing of all life? And this comes up in a number of different cases, one example being vegetarianism. And again, without getting into all of the details, but famously the Buddha didn't ban the eating of meat. And so people say, well, you know, the Buddha didn't say that you couldn't eat meat. That's true. And as a historical, I'm just for your information, I'm a lifelong vegetarian. Well, since I was 18, I've been vegetarian. And I would personally have loved it if the Buddha had said, you can't eat meat, right? That's my bias, but he didn't. And as a scholar, historical scholar of the suttas, then I have to admit, no, actually the Buddha didn't say you can't eat meat, even for the Sangha or for the lay people. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's the best thing to do. Times have changed since the Buddha's day. In the Buddha's day, most animals lived a perfectly happy and natural life until the time came for them to be killed. And eating meat was a part, fairly small part of people's diet, but was a normal sort of part of the landscape and the environment that they were living in. These days we have factory farms. We have I've heard in China they have like multi-story pig farms full of pigs, like skyscrapers full of pigs, and chicken farms, and they're horrible. We have fish boats trawling the seas, like these factories trawling the seas and just with nets scooping up, you know, countless thousands of tons of fish, most of which goes to waste. And the scale and the destruction of the way that we relate to animal life on the planet has changed completely from what it was in the past. And this has happened, I think, gradually, and I think it's happened a lot out of our sight, because, you know, most of us have moved from the village to a city, and we don't see what's happening so much, and we don't really understand the scale of it and the amount of suffering which is being created. So those conditions have changed. The environmental impact of it has changed. The welfare of the animals concerned has changed since the Buddha's time, and not in a good way. And so if a Buddhist says to me, you know, do I have to be vegetarian from a Buddhist point of view? Well, no, you don't have to be vegetarian. You can get away with not being vegetarian. But is it better to be vegetarian? Absolutely. Is it a deeper way of practicing that precept of the sacredness of all life? Absolutely it is. Is it a way of living that's expressing your Dhamma and your compassion and your love for all creatures through your actions? Then yes, of course, that's a beautiful thing to do. So this is what I mean when I'm talking about that our keeping of the precepts, we shouldn't be just concerned with checking off the boxes. Our moral life and our ethical life is not about getting a passing grade in our ethics exam. It's about being the best person that we can be. It's about challenging ourselves to think, how can we live in a way that is going to be creating less harm and more good? And there are many things that each of us can do that is going to do those things. And this is something that we can be and should be challenging ourselves with every day. And I use that particular example of the first precept and vegetarianism, but of course that's just one example, and there are many different ways that we could be challenging ourselves to live a better life. Now that challenge also has a psychological dimension as well. And so when we if we keep precepts in a narrow way, right? So we check the box, have I actually killed any living creature in the last 24 hours? No, great. Then of course that's fantastic, right? And we can feel happy because of that. But there's a deeper happiness that comes if we challenge ourselves and if we grow. And there's a happiness that comes that creeps up on you. Again, these things are not, they're not necessarily things that you like feel or experience or know right away, but there's something that grows with you in your life as you realize this kind of sense of connection and this sense of oneness that is irreplaceable and that is so precious. And when you see any living creature and you know that everything that you've done in your life has tried as much as you can to not harm any of these creatures and to allow them to flourish and to live a good life, then that makes your heart feel so beautiful. It makes you feel like this sense of, I don't know how to describe it, but this sense of, like almost a sense of innocence when you face the world. Like that you know that you've never wished harm on any creature and you've never done anything gratuitously that's going to cause harm for any creature. So the power of this precept, even just this first precept, is something we don't really understand for many years. It takes a long, long time and you gradually begin to understand it. So this has been a little talk for you this evening on keeping the morality and happiness in the path of Buddhism. Now, it's 8:20, and I believe we're wrapping up at 8:30, is that correct? That's correct. And do we have time for questions? Are we able to do that? I'm not really sure. I don't even know what app we... Sorry? You don't think we have that option? Okay, so we have people are there on chat. Okay, so, all right. So what I'll do, I will round out the talk for the next 10 minutes. But I think, okay, well, if we're not going to do chat, we won't do chat. So, okay, what I'll do is I'll round out the talk for the next 10 minutes. And I will say a couple of words that will introduce the topic that we're going to be talking about tomorrow. Which is the topic on calm and insight meditation. And particularly, what I'll talk about now is the link of morality with these things, which I was going to talk about tomorrow. But let me just mention that briefly. So we talked about how in the Buddhist path, we move from suffering into happiness. And we do, and I talked about how when the Buddha taught that, he helped us to break down that apparently insurmountable, huge mass of suffering into small steps that we can achieve. And it's as if there's a great mountain of the Himalayas, but this step is the first step. We can do this one step. And that one precept of not killing, that's something that we can do. And that's a huge step, actually. And that will give rise to a certain kind of happiness. Now, when we have that kind of happiness, then we're encouraged to take the next step. And we're encouraged to take the next step. And we're encouraged to take the next step. And so the Buddha is leading us on through this way of happiness and through this acknowledging of the happiness. So at each step of the way, we're letting go of that suffering behind and we're moving to a more subtle form of happiness in the future. Now, the happiness that we experience through generosity, through morality, this is a kind of like a fundamental human happiness that is the heritage of all people. The Buddha called these manusa dhamma. Manusa dhamma. So these precepts are manusa dhamma. They are something which is fundamental and natural to the human realm. Doesn't mean, of course, that everybody keeps them, right? But Buddha wasn't saying that everyone keeps these rules. In practice, of course, lots of people don't keep them. The point is, though, that keeping them is a way of being in tune with this human realm. Okay? And if we're not keeping them, we're somehow falling below. We're going down. And so we're keeping these precepts, we're keeping that realm, we're able to progress and able to advance. And when we've done that, we can then start asking ourselves, well, what next? If this step has led to happiness, where does the next step lead us to? And what might that be? And of course, the Buddha taught about these next steps in many different places and in many different ways. In the gradual training, for example, he talks about our practice of sense restraint, the practice of contentment, our practices of energy, practices of mindfulness and awareness. And all of these are ways that we can apply our effort in the Buddhist path to deepen our understanding and deepen the happiness that we've experienced from keeping our precepts, building up from what we kept our precepts. And we can do this a little bit by little bit. Now, of course, none of these things are simple, and none of these things are necessarily easy to do right away. Okay? But there are some things we can do. Practice of contentment is a very good one. Contentment means not having too much. It just doesn't mean you don't have anything, but it just means keep it simple. And that's something that we can all do. We can always be a bit simpler and have a bit less thing. Practice of mindfulness in daily life, this is something that's a bit more challenging. And I think it's worth noting that when the Buddha taught this, that he was talking about, primarily, he talked about that in the context of monastic life. So, and you know, talked about a monk who puts a robe up and then goes into the village and then stays mindful when they're in the village and then mindful when returning. And most of you probably know that keeping mindfulness is not always easy. And I think one of the unfortunate problems that we have is that a lot of us, myself included, learnt about mindfulness initially in an intensive retreat. So we go to an intensive retreat where we can practice very kind of slow mindfulness in every moment and every step, every breath. Of course, that's a wonderful practice to be able to do that. But then when we come out of that retreat and come back to our lives, we try to keep doing that and it doesn't work. And we're like, oh, what's wrong with us? Well, no. It doesn't work because it's too refined of a practice. So the mindfulness that we can practice in our everyday life is less refined, right? But perhaps more resilient. It's a different kind of mindfulness. It's different. It's appropriate in different contexts. So don't expect in your daily life to be able to have the same kind of very sharp, refined moment-to-moment mindfulness that you might have on an extended, intensive retreat. It's different. It's not better or worse. It's a different context. So all of these things will create a form of happiness which will lead to the mind becoming unsullied and becoming bright and will lead to the foundations of meditation. And I'm going to talk more about the meditation tomorrow. Okay, so we will talk about tomorrow about the different kinds of meditation and how to do that. So I'm going to wrap up the talk for this evening. And finish up with just a reminder that the talk tomorrow, which hopefully we'll all see you at tomorrow, will be half an hour later than scheduled. So I guess most of you are probably in Sydney. So for those of you in Sydney, the talk will be starting at 8 p.m. tomorrow. For those of you not in Sydney, then adjust accordingly. And also just mention while we're here that at the Lokanta Vihara in Harris Park that we're doing our regular talks on a Friday night, so you're most welcome to join us there. And various other things around the place. So hopefully that we can be there for you and to give you a little bit of support and encouragement in these difficult times. And I know that, you know, so many of you, everyone's going through hard times, even though everyone puts on a brave face, but all of us have been affected and all of us, our lives have been in a struggle and been diminished in one way or the other because of this pandemic. So everybody, the more we can work together, the more we can support each other, then the quicker that we will be over this and we can move on to a better year, hopefully next year. Okay, so I think that's probably enough for today. Thank you so much, everybody. Sadhu, 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 sadhu. And especially thanks to the Sangha here at the Amawatara Buddhist Center and all of the devotees here who have set up and maintained this very beautiful little vihara here in Carlingford. And we are so lucky to have these Dhamma family that we can come and share and spend a little bit of time with. Sadhu, sadhu.